Members, 10:30 having arrived, I'm going to call the May 5th, 2021 meeting of the House Taxes Committee to order. Welcome, everyone, and this is under Remote Rules 10.01. Members of the public, if you would like to see the materials that we're going to be going over today, the simplest way is just go to Minnesota House of Representatives, go to committees, and go to taxes, and it is right there off to the right-hand side. You will find all the materials that we as members and others on Zoom are seeing. So with that, Ms. Griska, if you would please take the roll.
Marquardt.
Marquardt present.
Marquardt present. Ms. Lagarde excused. Davids.
Davids present.
Davids present. Agbaje.
Present.
Agbaje present. Carlson. Carlson.
Carlson present.
Carlson present. Detmer. Detmer. Garofalo.
Garofalo present.
Garofalo present. Gomez.
Gomez present.
Gomez present. Her.
Her present.
Her present. Hertas.
Hertas present.
Hertas present. Howard.
Present.
Howard present. McDonald.
McDonald present.
McDonald present. Miller. Excused. Moran.
Present.
Moran present. Mortensen.
Present.
Mortensen present. Robbins.
Present.
Robbins present. Sandell.
Present.
Sandell present. Schultz.
Present.
Schultz present. Stevenson. Stevenson. Swazinski.
Swazinski present.
Swazinski present. Joachim.
Present.
Joachim present. Detmer. Stevenson. We have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Griska. We do have a quorum, and I do want the public to know that members may have to be in the meeting and out of the meeting because there's other committee meetings going on, other conference committee meetings going on, just so the public is aware of that. Next, we're going to move to the approval of the minutes. Representative McDonald, have you thoroughly researched the April 9th, 2021 minutes?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have not thoroughly read them, but I have read them, so I approve the minutes.
Very good. Representative McDonald moves to approve the April 9th, 2021 minutes of the Taxes Committee. Any discussion? If not, members, I'm going to ask you to momentarily unmute yourselves to vote on the April 9th, 2021 minutes. All those in favor say aye.
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 All say nay. The motion does prevail. The April 9th, 2021 minutes are approved. Members, we have two items on the agenda today, House File 600 and an overview of the American Rescue Plan Act. And so we're going to move to first House File 600. Do I hear a motion to move House File 600?
So move.
Representative Moran moves House File 600 be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. And with that, we have Majority Leader Representative Winkler. Welcome to the Taxes Committee. And if you would, I hear you have like an amendment to be put on before you talk about things, okay? Representative Moran, would you move the A33 amendment?
Yes, Chair Marquardt, I will move that amendment.
All right, Representative Moran moves the A33 amendment. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair and members, first of all, I just have to express my appreciation for your enthusiasm for approving the minutes. I'm going to try to bring some of that same enthusiasm to the Rules Committee in the future. So the A33 author's amendment is mostly just cleaning up changes that we've had going through the various committee stops already. And that list is very long. So there isn't a lot to really go over for this committee. It's just a cleanup author's amendment to get the bill ready for presentation.
Very good. Any questions, thoughts from members? Seeing none, we've got the A33 amendment. We're going to take a vote. All those in favor of the A33 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. The A33 amendment is adopted. Representative Winkler, the House File 600 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 600 creates a legal regulated marketplace for cannabis in Minnesota. It expunges criminal records for those convicted of cannabis crimes. It creates a marketplace focused on small and medium-sized businesses in Minnesota, and it moves to address some of the deep racial inequities in our criminal justice system in the way that we have policed cannabis in the past. Minnesotans strongly support legalization. Minnesotans across the state have personal experience with health conditions being improved with cannabis. They have seen that the current prohibition model using the criminal justice system has failed to keep cannabis out of the hands of kids. It has failed to stop the use of cannabis in Minnesota, and in fact has created more problems than cannabis itself. The policy goal behind this bill is to shift an illegal marketplace where people do not know what they're getting when they buy it, where we create criminal activity surrounding an illegal marketplace, and where we have a system of policing and arrests that fundamentally undermines the ability of certain communities, especially Black Minnesotans, ability to succeed and to live lives of productivity and health. So we tried to end the bad parts of prohibition. We tried to correct some of those harms, and we tried to create a legal marketplace based on the values that Minnesotans have told that they care about in this bill. So for this policy on taxes, and I'm going to stray into the kind of language I don't normally use. The goal in the taxes in this bill is to keep them low. It is to make sure that there is no barrier in migrating from an illegal marketplace into a legal regulated marketplace. Overtaxing at certain points has an effect on the marketplace, and we are being very careful not to do that. That's why we have a 10% gross receipts tax at the retail level. We don't tax the rest of the supply chain. We don't have high license fees or any license fees in the bill, and we tried to create a simple regulatory structure that people can use effectively and efficiently, and we can therefore make it relatively easy for people to migrate from an illegal marketplace into a safe, legal, regulated marketplace. And so for tax purposes, there are relatively few provisions in this bill. I want to say that while some people talk about cannabis legalization and talk about the economic benefits or the fiscal tax revenue collection benefits of legalization, that is not the goal of this bill. The goal of this bill is for cannabis to pay for itself, to pay for the taxation, to pay for its own regulation, to provide additional substance use disorder funding so people can get access to care that they need, to have better education standards about the dangers of cannabis that are based on public health information, not based on scare tactics. And the goal is to end the harms created by our current laws, mitigate the actual risks and dangers associated with cannabis use, and to do so in a way that allows Minnesotans to make responsible choices for themselves about how to use this product in a way that is similar to how we allow people to make their own decisions about alcohol and cigarettes. So that is the goal. That's how the bill has been structured. It's the product of a lot of public testimony and committee hearings in 15 town halls around the state, hundreds or thousands of hours of work by legislators and state agencies and advocacy groups, meetings with people who oppose the bill and trying to figure out ways of mitigating their concerns. And this bill is ready to move through this committee onto Ways and Means and to the floor of the House. And I ask for your support.
Thank you very much. Before we go to members' questions and testifiers, and then we'll have amendments too, I'm wondering, Representative Winkler, we could have staff too. Did you want to go over the specific items in Article 2 on taxes? What would you prefer? Would you like to do that, or would you like to have Ms. Hagler and staff do that?
Well, Mr. Chair, essentially, we create we have a 10% gross receipts tax on top of the standard sales tax at the retail level. We allow business deductions for expenses to be in this business in the state tax code because since this is a federal, under the federal tax code, they couldn't deduct those expenses. We do that. And there may be other items that are more technical or more detailed that this committee is interested in diving into. And for a level beyond what I just described, I would recommend you go to nonpartisan staff.
Very good. And then I do want to direct people's attention to the revenue estimate. So for starting in 2023, it's $14.5 million. And then into 24 and 25, it's $165 million. So, Representative Winkler, could you kind of explain that, why it seems like there's a big increase there from 23 to 24, 25 on the revenue estimate?
Mr. Chair, it just reflects the time it takes to establish the marketplace. Likely there would be no, you know, we're creating a whole regulatory structure, highly unlikely that we would be ready to see sales before a year passes by. Then the supply has to be ramped up through businesses getting licenses, establishing retail operations, and so forth. So it would just take time. And, you know, as until that time, there will be a lot of illegal cannabis sales in Minnesota. But as the system shifts from the illegal market into the legal marketplace, then the revenue estimates will start to climb. So it just reflects a ramp up as the industry takes off.
Very good, thank you. So I'm gonna go to one legislator at this point, Representative Swazinski, and then I'm gonna go to testifiers, then we'll come back to amendments and other members' questions. So Representative Swazinski.
This is Chris, can you hear me?
Yep. Yes, we can. Yes,
thank you. Thank you. Just a question for Representative Winkler. You know, just kind of looking from a tax perspective, obviously we saw with cigarette tax, the increase. We've had a lot of calls by the department to increase staffing because of illegal sales, you know, people going across the border, buying cigarettes coming into the state. What will be more expensive when it comes to taxes? Well, you know, you stated you don't want to create an onerous program. You don't want to have high taxes related to marijuana. What will be, when it comes to like, what will be higher, taxes on cigarettes or taxes on marijuana if your bill passes?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Swazinski, I don't actually know the current tax rates for cigarettes, but I think they're taxed differently. I think it's a different way of calculating it. So I don't know what the total tax effect would be between those two things, but maybe somebody could help out. I will say it will be alcohol. The whole system of alcohol taxation is significantly higher than what we will have for cannabis.
Very good. Ms. Hagler, would you care to answer that question?
Mr. Chair and representatives, I can clarify a little bit and excuse me, because marijuana gross receipts tax is just that, a gross receipts tax, it's a little bit difficult to actually estimate how much tax will actually be imposed on action. A lot of it depends on how the sales price of the actual product, and I believe our tax on cigarettes, the per pack rate with the $3.04 rate plus all of the other fees that come somewhere around like $8 to $9 and 50 cents per pack, including the tax and the sales. So it is a little bit difficult to be greater in the end without knowing how much the transaction is for.
Okay, Ms. Hagler, you're cutting in and out a little bit, at least what I'm hearing, so I don't know if you can correct that at all, but I think, you know, it's cigarettes per pack, $3.04, I believe. So Representative Swazinski.
Well, I think that's generally my point. My fear is what you're going to see is Clean Air Minnesota will appreciate this bill because of the high taxes on tobacco, will simply move the market to marijuana. And then how will it handle from a blended standpoint? If we have low taxes on marijuana and potentially we have a blended products that are being created within the state that are part tobacco and part marijuana, how will the state handle that regulation and how will that be taxed?
Representative Winkler.
Representative Swiedzinski, first of all, only products approved by the Cannabis Management Board can be offered for sale. So I don't know whether there is standing interpretation in the Department of Revenue for products that maybe have different tax rates and they're combined together. I don't know if there's a system for doing that or way of allocating the proceeds or not. But there would be ample time to determine the appropriate tax rate for blended products, which may or may not ever exist in Minnesota, depending on their safety and other concerns that may be raised for retail sale. It may be that people can combine them together on their own, but we don't really know if that product will ever exist. And the process is such that only once the Cannabis Management Board approves it can a product be sold.
Representative Swiedzinski. Okay.
I was trying to be, hey, Mr. Chair, sorry about that.
Very good.
I had myself muted. And just a general question. So the Department of Revenue will be handling the enforcement, or will the Cannabis Board as a separate entity be handling enforcement from the taxation, regulation, and enforcement side?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Swiedzinski, the Department of Revenue would handle tax enforcement. And the fiscal note shows that they're really gearing up to do that. The other kinds of enforcement, like in terms of violating license standards, et cetera, that would be a regulatory decision made through the Cannabis Management Board. So on the revenue side, it would be revenue. On other licensing type issues related to operations of businesses, that comes through the Cannabis Management Board.
Representative Swiedzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm good.
Okay, I'm going to take one more member, and then we're going to go to testifiers. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. I'm just trying to find a note here in one of the sections of the bill. So I do have a question for the author regarding the 10% tax, and I appreciate your comment. And you're recognizing that overtaxing the marketplace definitely has its problems. And I'm very delighted that you recognize that. I know you're a smart man, so you've probably done that for quite some time, Representative Winkler.
I thought you would like that, Representative McDonald.
Yes, thank you. See, question regarding some of the taxes, and maybe the staff can help. Will there be any of that funds to go for smoking cessation? Much like the tobacco tax. I notice in your bill, you have a section in there. I'm trying to find the section here as I'm speaking, but in regards to, let's see if I can find it here. It has regards to any of the problems that this would cause and for those who become addicted and helping those who in that category, in that section, I'll try to find it. But do you know, Representative Winkler, will some of this tax money be appropriated for smoking cessation?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, in fact, we have millions of dollars going to the Minnesota Department of Health to engage in public health, essentially, I don't want to say anti-cannabis, but basically public health messaging about the dangers of cannabis consumption. And we have language requiring education standards to be developed for schools related to this and to spend money on youth access prevention. We also have money in the bill going to fund access to counseling and to treatment for substance use disorder. and a number of other approaches. Essentially, every concern raised by public health officials, activists, et cetera, related to the dangers of cannabis use, we have appropriated money in the bill to help mitigate that by using a public health approach.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Winkler. Yes, I do find that I see that section now with the Cannabis Substance Use Disorder Advisory Council. So in a way, your comment earlier that having marijuana be illegal has caused more problems than cannabis itself. In a way, this bill will also cause some problems because of the section that you recognize, the Cannabis Substance Use Disorder Advisory Council, and what it could potentially happen to those who get addicted to it or misuse it. So I'm glad that you recognize that. It's kind of an ox. It's a double-edged sword there. Wouldn't you agree?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, cannabis use is widespread in Minnesota. And has been for a long time. There are some harms associated with it. There is, I am not going to be one of the people who says that there are, it's only positive. There are harms. Those harms currently exist, and we do a particularly bad job of addressing them. The point of this bill is to shift the focus away from using arrests and imprisonment and parole and probation as a way of controlling this substance, which is widely used and widely supported in Minnesota, and shifting to a regulation and public health approach to the harms, while recognizing the fact that it can be used safely by a lot of people if they're responsible and moderate in their use.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Winkler. I do recognize that as well. I understand the situation, how it can really free up that for those folks who have been imprisoned and in areas of our state that should not be because of the use. So that's all I have, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So we'll go to the five testifiers, and I would ask the five testifiers to stick around after you're done. So what I'd like to do, members, is hear from the five testifiers, and then we will ask questions of the testifiers afterwards if you have them. So first up is Anthony Newby, and Elaine Rasmussen is next. If I could ask testifiers to hold your testimony to, you know, 2 minutes, 3 minutes at the very max, that would be great. So, Anthony Newby, please introduce yourself for the committee and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Honorable Chair Marquardt and Tax Committee members. Thanks for allowing my testimony today. My name is Anthony Newby. I'm a Minnesota native and the co-owner of a hemp and CBD business located in downtown Minneapolis. My CBD brand, Cultivated CBD, is sold in over 600 retail stores. We sell online, advertise on KFAN radio, and ship to states all over the country. I'm also a leader of the Minority Cannabis Business Association, an organization network of cannabis operators throughout the nation helping to inform equitable cannabis policy in emerging states. I'm speaking today in favor of House File 600. I've read the bill, as have my colleagues throughout the nation, and I believe it to be one of the best legislative models in the nation. I'd like to focus on the taxation structure laid out in House File 600. From my perspective, the tax provisions will accomplish three important goals. Number one, it'll create a deliberately low tax rate, as Representative Winkler had said, one that encourages participation from small businesses like mine. I frankly need the lion's share of the profits to go back into my business, to hire more people, invest in production, allow us to focus on high quality consumer goods. We're just beginning to recover from the pandemic and social unrest. We can't out-tax the economy before it begins. This is a deliberately low tax rate, and it's the right thing. Secondly, House File 600 creates a tax structure that will limit the price of consumer goods. Tax rates, when they're too high, will elevate the price of legal cannabis well above the underground market prices and will actually encourage illegal markets. Lower prices aren't just good for consumers. A healthy taxation structure like that in House File 600 will discourage consumers and producers alike from seeking underground market alternatives. And point three, the bill creates a pool of taxes not just to cover the costs of regulatory enforcement, and it does that with money poured into a range of state agencies like the Department of Health, Department of Ag, Department of Labor, and others, but it also routes some of the tax benefits to local communities. House File 600 will support programs that educate youth and adults about substance abuse and treatment options. It funds expungement for prior cannabis convictions, some in my network. I've got plenty of friends and even family that have suffered under prohibition, and this expungement provision is a big deal. It also offers technical support for small businesses and Black-owned businesses like mine. The tax structure accomplishes all those things in House File 600. Frankly, looking ahead, as you all know, the end of cannabis prohibition is coming to Minnesota, like it is the border states of South Dakota, North Dakota, Wisconsin. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when and how we regulate this new economic opportunity. If we do this right, we'll create some 45,000 new jobs in year one of adult use legalization. The state will collect some $150 million in taxes out of the gate, more as consumption rates increase. We'll move from a culture of, frankly, nonsense.
Mr. Newby, would you finish up, please?
Very good. We'll move from punitive law enforcement to an economy of scale. House File 600 and its tax structure are the right structure. It'll give an on-ramp for businesses like mine, help reduce economic inequality. And I want to thank you, committee chair and committee members, for the time today. Please
thank
pass
you
it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next up is Elaine Rasmussen, and then Lilai Fatehi, and I apologize, is on deck for the mispronunciation, I'm sure. So, Elaine Rasmussen, please introduce yourself and begin your testimony, and welcome to the committee. Elaine Rasmussen. Okay, I think we will, she is not here. So, Lilai Fatehi, and I apologize. If you would introduce your name for the committee and begin your testimony.
Happy to, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lilai Fatehi, and I am the campaign manager for Minnesotans for Responsible Marijuana Regulation, or MRMR. We're a statewide multipartisan campaign organized by leaders from state and local units of government, a broad range of nonprofit organizations, members of Minnesota's business community, organized labor, and more. We formed MRMR with the goal of not just legalizing adult use cannabis in Minnesota, but more specifically replacing and repairing the damage caused by the complete and utter failure that is cannabis prohibition. And replacing that with a well-regulated and inclusive cannabis industry that promotes consumer safety, creates diverse economic opportunities and jobs for Minnesotans across the state, and invests resources back into our communities, and especially those communities that have been most disproportionately harmed by the racist policies of prohibition and the war on drugs. Cannabis prohibition has failed to achieve every single one of its stated public policy goals. It has failed to eliminate the sale and use of cannabis and instead driven it into an underground market that lacks consumer safety standards and is more readily accessible to children than alcohol or tobacco are. It has failed to keep our communities safer, has failed to keep them healthier, and instead it has disenfranchised entire segments of our society from being able to access employment, housing, and other basic needs. MRMR supports House File 600 because it's a well-considered and inclusive approach to establishing a legal cannabis industry in Minnesota that prioritizes Minnesotan safety, invests in Minnesotans' jobs, businesses, and communities. We were particularly supportive of this bill because we know it was developed through very extensive consultation and collaboration with stakeholders and is based on some of the most thorough research and detailed consideration that we've seen in any state. We've seen states take a variety of approaches to taxation on adult use cannabis. MRMR supports the establishment of a legal and well-regulated adult use cannabis market subject to taxation that's sufficiently low to ensure illegal sales are non-competitive and sufficiently high to ensure adequate revenue for funding harm mitigation and opportunity generating programs and activities. And we believe House File 600 does exactly that, and we urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next up is Elliot Ginsburg, and then Marcus Harkis will be the final testifier. So Elliot Ginsburg, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee. My name is Elliot Ginsburg. I am a lawyer in town at the firm Garner, Ginsburg & Johnson. We represent franchisees, people in the alcohol beverage industry, and people in the cannabis industry. Where I wanted to start briefly was Representative Winkler mentioned early on that this was not going to solve Minnesota's fiscal problems. And he's right. It's not intended to. The reason that that is a good thing can be seen in California. So California, the effective tax rate on cannabis is about 40%. And what they've seen is that they've had a very difficult time getting people to move from the illegal underground market into the regulated market that provides the state with tax revenue, which has also ultimately reduced the tax revenue that they otherwise would be getting. In addition to that, what states have seen with cannabis have impacted not only revenue directly from the sale of cannabis, but also revenue from property taxes. Previously vacant warehouses are being picked up regularly by businesses in states where cannabis is legal for grow facilities. That increases property taxes, it creates jobs. And there's also evidence that home values have increased 6% in cities where cannabis sales are legal. And this was a University of Mississippi study. They determined that the reason that home values increased so much in cities where it was legal was because they were attracting people who use cannabis, but also entrepreneurs and job seekers. House File 600 does an excellent job of balancing the need to pay for implementation and regulation, and also build a market that is going to have broad implications across the tax base, not just on the sale of cannabis. And I think that needs to be considered as we move forward. Very briefly, I just want to mention one city, a town in Colorado that had some interesting experience, Trinidad in Colorado. Years ago, oil prices dove and they lost their main industry. So their economy was falling apart. They had been losing population for 5 years, and then cannabis was legalized. What they saw was a 21% increase in sales tax because 8 shops opened up, an increase in jobs, $1.5 million extra in the city's coffers, and the first time in 6 years that the population did not decrease. I think House File 600 is an excellent balance between generating tax revenue for Minnesota and also for benefiting the economy as a whole. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Last testifier is Marcus Harkis. You would please identify yourself for the committee and welcome.
Good morning and thank you. I'm in California right now. And I have visited Trinidad. It's booming down there. So I'm
please
Mark
proceed.
Harkis.
Please identify yourself and please proceed.
I'm Marcus Harkis. I'm a family man. I'm a writer, organizer, social entrepreneur, and a legalization advocate from North Minneapolis. I've studied the unjust history of prohibition and the emerging legal cannabis industry for the past 7 years. And I've also been a cannabis consumer for 23 years, simply because it makes me feel better. In fact, all Minnesotans who smoke, vape, or otherwise ingest cannabis do so because it makes us feel better. I've never been a criminal, but I grew up being treated like one by the police, pulled over for driving and walking while black 50 times, mostly in my teens and 20s. There are more victims of prohibition than the thousands of Minnesotans arrested for cannabis. I've never been arrested for it, but I have been a victim because I've been harassed, searched, disrespected, and assaulted by cops, and also discriminated against by employers. It was excessive police harassment and police violence that gave me PTSD, but cannabis helped me to drop the D. Cannabis is a healing plant. It's not a dangerous killer drug. The most dangerous thing about cannabis is getting caught with it, because you can lose your freedom, your job, your housing, and even your children. So that's why I say prohibition is the problem, not cannabis. Prohibition adds no value to public safety. It wastes law enforcement resources. It causes communities to distrust police, and it ruins lives. Cannabis has no lethal dose, but thousands of Minnesotans have their lives harmed, if not ruined, by this criminalization and disenfranchisement every year. How can prohibitions be indifferent about this? There's not a single good reason to justify prohibition, but the imperatives for full legalization include respecting personal freedom, increasing public safety, improving public health, creating economic development, and advancing this social justice and racial equity. I'm just one of hundreds of thousands of Minnesotan adult cannabis consumers who are tired of living in a draconian police state, but most are too afraid to tell you that we feel oppressed and we simply want to live free. The most salient question in this debate is not if you believe people should consume cannabis, but if you believe Minnesotans should be criminalized for it. When we say that prohibition has failed, we're not merely talking about all of the people who consume cannabis. We're acknowledging that there is a $500 million illicit cannabis market alive in Minnesota now, in spite of all these arrests. We want to have the best model of full legalization in the nation, which means an equitably regulated, reasonably taxed, and justly reparative of prohibition victims. House File 600 proposes that our state moves in that direction and not establish a prohibition-like model like most states, including California, have created. Full legalization has the potential to create a couple thousand legal regulated tax businesses and more than 20,000 jobs. All of those businesses and jobs will generate enough tax revenue without needing to overtax and overregulate this new market.
Mr. Farkas, would you, okay, please, yeah, wrap up, please.
Okay, thank you. Finally, the illicit market, it feeds a lot of people with low to moderate incomes, and we believe those with actual entrepreneur skills should be supported in transitioning to the emerging legal market. So please pass House File 600. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, any questions for the four testifiers? I don't see any. So at this time, I'd like to go to amendments. We have two other amendments, and we've got the A36 amendment. I think Representative Garofalo, is that your amendment?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chairman. Let me just bring it up here. Mr. Chairman, can you hear me okay?
I can. Would you please move the A36?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move the A36 amendment for consideration. And members, what this amendment does, I've heard the public testimony on this that people say the stated objective of this program is not to provide additional revenue sources to grow government or expand government. So what this amendment would do is that once the costs of the regulation of the program, once the costs that are outlined in the House File 600 are laid out, all additional proceeds, all additional tax revenue directly as a result of the taxation of marijuana would go into a tax relief account. That tax relief account would be outside of the general fund. It does not specify which specific taxes would be lowered or what fees would be lowered, but it does say that the funds here should be used with a priority given to lower tax rates and lower fees for low and middle income taxpayers. And so, again, from my perspective, this aligns with the stated objective of what proponents of the bill have said. This will allow for any extra revenue above the regulatory costs to be dedicated into an account for tax relief that would be used for legislatures to decide. And I would ask for member support.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the A36, Representative Garofalo is correct. That is the goal of this program. It is to create a safe, legal, regulated marketplace where cannabis pays for itself, not to collect additional resources for the state for other purposes. I think states have made a mistake in trying to raise cannabis taxes to pay for other things, and they have it's resulted in a less successful regulatory situation for cannabis. So based on that, I would urge members to accept the A36 amendment.
Any other discussion on the A36 amendment? Representative Robbins.
Thank you.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Garofalo. So just to clarify, you want the money raised through the tax to only go towards the cost of regulating the program, not for the additional programs like expanded treatment, substance use disorder, education, et cetera.
Representative Robbins, is that for Representative Ruffalo, the author of the amendment?
Yes.
Okay, Representative Ruffalo.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative Robbins, the way the amendment is drafted is that the bill as it exists, it funds the items that are in House File 600. So the $9 million in fiscal year 24, the $16 million in fiscal year 25, that's designated for substance use disorder treatment and the prevention grant account, those would still be funded. The reason why I'm offering this version is that the fiscal note makes conservative fiscal assumptions. It's based off of three things in the fiscal note. Number one, what are the costs of the program? Number two, what is the tax rate? Number three, what are the assumptions of use? If you look at the states around us, none of the states around us have legalized marijuana. And so places, population centers such as Fargo in North Dakota, Sioux Falls in South Dakota, in Wisconsin, La Crosse, Hudson, and Superior, I believe that we will see some migration into Minnesota for this commercial activity. So my opinion is that the tax revenues are going to end up being much larger than are currently in the fiscal note. It's not a criticism of the fiscal note. It's just my assumption on it based on other states and Minnesotans' behavior in other areas. And so this funds the items in House File 600. It doesn't defund any of them. But all the extra tax revenue that may or may not come in would go into a tax relief account. It would not be used to grow government. It would be used to lower taxes and fees in other areas.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Garofalo. I just wanted to clarify that because you had specified it would just address the regulatory costs. So I wanted to make sure that was on the record.
Okay. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm in a conference committee at the same time, so I haven't actually looked at the amendment, so I'm really sorry if this is a question that's answered in that. But I guess tax relief fund is a term that I haven't heard before, and I wonder if Representative Garofalo can tell me a little bit more about that, like, because obviously you're saying that you want excess revenue to go to offset taxes. And I guess I'm just wondering, like, what taxes, how does that get decided? If you can tell me a little bit more about that.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and Representative Gomez, as always, you can always trust that a Garofalo amendment is the right vote to cast, Representative Gomez. So don't worry about reading the substance of it. No, in state statute, there used to be a tax relief account where proceeds would go into it that would be set aside for providing tax relief. In 2008, that was repealed. This would bring back that tax relief account. So the money that would go into this is not, it's not appropriated to a specific tax reduction or to a specific fee reduction. What it would do is take that revenue out of the general fund. So this is once the cost of House File 600 have been paid for. So once that revenue is over there, then subsequent legislatures would use that money for the tax and fee relief that they determine. But it doesn't specify which taxes or which fees. It's just the purpose clause of that section is that the purpose of this account is to provide offsetting tax relief through rate and fee reductions with a priority given to lower tax rates and fees of lower and middle income taxpayers. So that would be the purpose statement of the fund.
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for that, Representative Garofalo. So just, you know, when this was in place, like, does the tax committee then decide how those funds are allocated, or like how did that happen when it was in place, if you would?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gomez, in the old days, legislators got to decide how money was spent and what decisions were made. So yes, presumably this account would be under the jurisdiction of future tax committees.
Representative Gomez.
That's good. Thank you. I guess, you know, for me, I think that we're kind of open to this amendment, but, you know, just in my few years, I guess my observation is that once there's a line item in our budget, then it's like easier to shovel money into that line item. So, you know, this isn't like my favorite idea, I guess, if we're talking about creating or reviving a mechanism to reduce, you know, revenue to the general fund when overall kind of like our government are the money that we're spending to you know, on education or housing or whatever on down the line, when you look at it for over sort of over you know, the course of the since 2002 in particular, that it really hasn't kept pace. So I guess that's just my comment about it, but I appreciate the answers and the conversation, Representative Garofalo.
So Representative Garofalo, final comments on the A36 amendment.
No, I just ask for member support.
Very good. I am going to call for the vote on the A36 amendment. Members, please unmute yourself. All those in favor of the A36 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, say nay. The motion does prevail. The A36 amendment is adopted. We have an A31 amendment. Representative Hertaus, would you like to move the A31 amendment?
Well, good morning, Mr. Chair, and thank you. Yes, I'd like to move the A31 amendment for consideration to House File 600.
Very good. Representative Hertaus.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And Representative Winkler, over the past many years, I have found myself on the same side of an issue with you on several subjects, such as early learning scholarships, the Second Chance Coalition, expungement of low-level crimes and decriminalization. And both your introduction today and also in a committee, workforce committee meeting back in March, it caught my attention with regard to your particular policy about taxation. And so I think we find ourselves in congruency again with respect to a policy about taxation. And so the amendment simply says that it's the finding of the Minnesota House of Representatives that when it comes to businesses, we don't want to taxes to be too high. We don't want regulatory burdens to be too difficult to navigate. And that these types of policies create barriers that we have often seen in other states. And so acknowledging that high taxes causes money to flow to other states. So that's a simple statement based on the author's past testimony, both today and in previous committee. And I would hope that the author would view this as a friendly amendment.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertaus, I mean, you've already got me to say tax relief and that we don't want to grow government. But to put that into finding is a little bit too far. Generally, we don't do findings. And I will, you know, agree with you that at a certain point, taxes can be too high, and it depends on the circumstances, and we have to weigh that carefully against other needs. So we might disagree about where that line is in certain circumstances, but there is a line. And so I'd ask members not to support the amendment, but I would be more than happy to have a long conversation about the dangers of growing government and the importance of tax relief in certain areas if that would help move the support for the bill.
Representative Hertaus, final comments on the A31 amendment.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your comment, Representative Winkler. I see that you are moving the ball in the legalization of cannabis, and that you probably view it as joining more of a mainstream attitude amongst the several states with regard to how we go forward on cannabis. I think the parallel that I'm trying to demonstrate here is that we are a different economy than we were 40 or 50 years ago. We didn't have the types of access to other markets as individual consumers that we have today. For example, you can go to Amazon, eBay, Costco, Walmart, Target, even the Google Lead service, and find product available to be shipped directly to your door by companies in other states that operate under different economic circumstances. So when you do the Google Lead service, you know, you search any product, have it brought to your door, as I mentioned. And, you know, just for example, recently, within the last several weeks, I personally have found the best deal on a water softener shipped from another state directly to my door, purchased an instrument cluster for one of my vehicles that had gone haywire directly to my door, an antenna for my motorcycle, Lutron remote Wi-Fi devices that I can operate from my phone for different properties that I have. I can turn lights on and off or operate things remotely. And light fixtures, and it goes on and on. I'd talk for the next 20 minutes if I talked to you about what my wife buys online. So I think the point I'm trying to make is that the competitiveness for business in Minnesota is not captive just to our borders, and we're having to compete interstate. And so I hope that we give future consideration to our tax policies on this. And I did not expect that you probably would find this as a friendly amendment, but nonetheless, I think I've made my point. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hertaus. I'm going to call for the vote on the A31 amendment. If members would please unmute themselves. All those in favor of the A31 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say nay.
No.
The motion does not prevail. The A31 amendment is not adopted. Members, we've got some time for debate. I do want to vote by about 11:28 so we can move on at 11:30, but we've got a few minutes. So Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just got off the phone with the TAG, the Adjutant General's Office, and we need to really bring up this point that currently, still, the federal law, marijuana use is illegal across our country. Even despite what a state might pass, it as an illegal substance, but it's still illegal for our men and women serving in our military. And I want to make that very clear. I don't think this is a good move for our state. I don't think it's a good move for our young people serving in the military. It just makes the product more available. And they see that it's legal now if it passes here in Minnesota. We have a fighting force that needs to be ready to go at any time, whether it's the National Guard here in Minnesota, or the federal services that serve overseas. And we can see what chemicals can do to people. And I don't think the black market's gonna go away. It's still gonna be there. And what the black market will do, or I should say the illegal market, to be politically correct, the illegal market will just lower their prices. And I don't see this as a good move for Minnesota. I don't see it's a good move for our young people in school. I taught for 34 years. I can see what these types of things can do. They look at adults for role models. And we are role models for our young people. And if mom and dad say that marijuana is okay, you know, what's to stop young people from making up their own minds about the use of marijuana? Many of them have already made up their minds, and we're just making it more accessible. So from a military point of view, I think it's a wrong move. I think, you know, we have medical marijuana for people, for the population that we passed a few years ago. But still, that's not something that the military can access either. So my point is I hope is well taken, because I can't support this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So we've got Representative Garofalo, Representative Hertaus, and then the author of the bill, Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Quick questions. First of all, what is the motion on the bill today? What committee is it going to next?
Yeah, it will be House File 600 as amended, be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay, so Mr. Chairman and Representative Winkler, I have some questions and comments about the spending in this bill, but I'll save that for Ways and Means when it's there. Mr. Chairman, a quick question for our nonpartisan staff. I know that in the area of marijuana, there are indoor growing operations, and does nonpartisan staff know if those indoor growing operations, if their property tax classification rates are commercial industrial or if they qualify for the lower agriculture classification rate.
Ms. Hagler?
Mr. Chair, I'm just going to leave my camera off. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So as the bill is written right now, the growers would have a commercial industrial classification as the products are not considered agricultural products for the purposes of the 2A or 2B classification.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Garofalo.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's good to hear that. And Representative Winkler, first of all, thank you for accepting the amendment that I offered. I do have concerns with your bill, but I also think that those concerns are now outside of the jurisdiction of the Tax Committee. With regards to how this bill is structured right now from a tax perspective, what I see is a bill that is going to lower the taxes that people are forced to pay, and it's going to finance it by paying for it with taxes that people are choosing to pay. And at the end of the day, that is a pretty appealing interest to me in terms of our tax code. If we're confiscating from people and paying for it by having people choose to pay taxes, I think that's a good thing. So, Mr. Chairman and Representative Representative Winkler, I'm going to support your bill today, but I do want to work with you before Ways and Means on some of the other items in the bill that I think people should know I do not support and should be addressed. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Winkler, I had three quick questions. The first, Representative Detmer kind of went over. I share concerns about possession and use of cannabis as it relates to federal firearm laws and whether or not there's going to be any effort to warn the public or make users of cannabis aware of the conflict between our laws and the federal laws. Is there going to be any effort whatsoever with regard to this legislation to make people aware of the pitfalls of the conflict between federal and state laws?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertaus, you raise an interesting point. I don't have anything in the bill that I right now to warn people that they could be in violation of federal law for consuming products as, you know, potentially part of a product warning or something like that. But I'm very open to figuring out how to do that. And we would still have time to work on something like that. I think it's important to note that through multiple administrations of both parties, the federal policy has been that they will not enforce cannabis laws in states that have legalized. So they are using their prosecutorial discretion to essentially decide not to prosecute cases or go after cases in states that have legalized. And that's been true across the Trump administration, Biden, Obama, and I'm not sure how far back it goes, potentially back into the Bush administration.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that answer, Representative Winkler. And I am aware that there are certain conflicts with regard to firearm quick checks and use of cannabis, and that people may unknowingly deny themselves some of their access to Second Amendment rights because of their unknowing use or even registering for a medical card or cannabis. The second question relates a little bit to this. Going back several decades, when I was a teenager, when cannabis was widely used in the late 60s and 70s, I think baby boomers, by and large, may have a somewhat laissez-faire attitude about adoption of this as making it legal because of their recollection of what pot or cannabis was back in those days. It is my understanding, and I may be wrong, but it's my understanding that because of the quantity limits over the past several decades, growers of cannabis have been able to hybridize cannabis to have much higher levels of TCH or THC content in it. And so the cannabis of today, I'm told, is much more potent and much stronger than it was for the youth of my generation. So I saw on the schedule of different quantities and the fines that would be associated with it, it relates to ounces and grams and also THC content. But how does somebody, I mean, it's kind of a either or, not and, kind of a prescription in terms of these levels. If you had more than 800 milligrams, but had higher than 4 grams of THC, how does law enforcement know what that is if you would be suspect of violating this? How is that handled in terms of charges or testing or whatever? And I see the fines go up quite rigidly for larger quantities, but this not only has huge financial penalties, but promises to create an additional array of indictments and getting in the snare of the law by people thinking that it's okay to have legal cannabis and violating some of these prescriptive limits within it, right down to even 4 or fewer mature flowering plants in your own backyard. I mean, who are the pot plant cops going to be enforcing this? I mean, it's probably moot to even have it in the bill.
So Representative Winkler, and I do want to move to the vote here shortly. So Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Pertas. So first of all, no product can be sold in the marketplace unless it is approved by the Cannabis Management Board. And we have a seed to sale tracking system, which technology exists, it's widely used and it's required. So, and there are product labeling, packaging, and other kinds of consumer protection restrictions. And so the Cannabis Management Board can set, and their mandate is public safety and public health. So they can set standards, they can approve products, they can provide regulations for exactly how those products would be moved to market. So you could have, I suppose, a counterfeit product that looks like something that you would buy at a licensed retailer that it does something else. But bottom line is, through the regulated marketplace, you know exactly what you're getting, where it came from, and it all has to be tracked from seed to final sale.
So Representative Hertaus, do you have one final question here, if you could get to that?
Yes, thank you. And it doesn't even have to be a question, just a closing comment.
Okay.
This bill allows that once a $250 license application fee is paid and an application or license is granted, that there would be no renewal fees. And I would just I support that whole notion of no renewal fees, but we should be looking at the same thing for so many of our jobs and occupations and industries that we currently, 34% of all of our jobs and occupations, creates barriers to the licensing of a lot of things that we just simply don't need to do. And people are paying literally, in some cases, thousands of dollars a year to renew their licenses and have onerous and cumbersome continuing education requirements, which takes away from actually working and earning a living. So I hope that we can continue to have a conversation about license renewals and license fees. They have become a source of revenue rather than just to pay the cost of reissuing that license. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, members. Representative Winkler, closing comments.
Thank you,
House File 600 is amended.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I appreciate the time. I ask for your support today. I think we are setting ourselves on a path of an effective regulatory system for dealing with a product that is widely used in Minnesota today, can be used safely, is as safe as other legal products, where we take a regulated public health taxation approach to dealing with it rather than using police and prisons, which don't work and cause a lot of harm. So I ask for your support today.
Thank you very much, Representative Winkler. Representative Moran renews her motion that House File 600, as amended, be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. And Ms. Griska, please take the roll.
Marquardt.
Marquardt, pass.
Marquardt, pass. Lisligard, excused. Davids.
Davids, no.
Davids, no. Agbaje.
Agbaje, aye.
Agbaje, aye. Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Carlson, aye. Detmer.
Detmer, nay.
Detmer, nay. Garofalo.
Aye.
Garofalo, aye. Gomez.
Gomez, aye.
Gomez, aye. Herr.
Herr, aye.
Herr, aye. Hertas.
Not yet, no.
Hertas, no. Howard.
Aye.
Howard, aye. McDonald.
Nay.
McDonald, nay. Miller. Excused. Moran.
Moran, aye.
Moran, aye. Mortensen.
Aye.
Mortensen, aye. Robbins.
No.
Robbins, aye. Sandell.
No, aye. I said no.
Oh, Robin. Sorry. No. Sandell.
Sandell says aye.
Sandell, aye. Schultz.
Schultz, aye.
Schultz, aye. Stevenson.
Stevenson, aye.
Stevenson, aye. Swazinski.
No.
Swazinski, no. Joachim.
Joachim, aye.
Joachim, aye. We have 12 ayes, 6 noes.
There being 12 ayes and 6 noes, the Moran motion to re-refer House File 600 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee is adopted, is approved. So thank you, Majority Leader Winkler, and I know you have a few more stops yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. All right, members, we're going to move to an overview of the tax conformity of the American Rescue Plan Act that was recently passed by the federal government. And, most of the items, all but one basically, are tax year 2021. So it isn't items that this tax committee is going to be facing at one time or another. And this is just an overview to kind of keep members up to date and informed on the conformity items that this committee will be seeing. So with that, Mr. Williams and Mr. Clayman, if you would like to go over your presentation, and there was a memorandum that members should also have. So Mr. Williams.
Chair Markward and members, I'm going to be working off of the table in the memo that was posted on the committee website and distributed to members today. We're going to be discussing three broad categories of changes that were in the American Rescue Plan Act, or ARPA, that are issues of federal tax conformity that the committee might face. The three categories are changes to federal tax credits that affect Minnesota liability, changes to federal adjusted gross income that affect Minnesota liability, and then certain business tax changes. I'm going to start with the changes to federal tax credits, and I think it's worth kind of briefly mentioning that typically changes to federal tax credits don't affect state liability because those are sort of later in the tax calculation after Minnesota sort of has broken off from the federal system, starting with FAGI. However, in this case, the state working family credit includes a rule that to be eligible for the state working family credit, you also have to be eligible for the federal earned income credit. And there's some provisions in the American Rescue Plan Act that expand eligibility for the federal earned income credit that would flow through to Minnesota. And then there's also some changes to the dependent care credit. And because the state's dependent care credit is set to equal the federal dependent care credit amount, those would also both flow through to Minnesota. So starting with the first line of the table that's in front of you, there's some special rules for the earned income credit federally for individuals without children. Sort of the three broad categories of individuals that don't have children that are allowed to claim the earned income credit under the American Rescue Plan Act are childless individuals who are 19 that are not students, 18-year-olds who are qualified homeless youth or former foster youth, and then people ages 65 and older. And so those changes are effective for tax year 21 only, so they're one-time provisions in federal law. There's also a provision relating to childless individuals who are eligible for the earned income credit but can't claim it because their children lack identification, Social Security number is required to claim the credit. So current federal law says you can't claim the childless earned income credit if you have children but they don't qualify for the earned income credit. So that the Rescue Plan Act makes repeals that requirement for tax year 21 and later, so that's a permanent change. There's also a provision that allows the earned income credit for certain separated spouses who are disallowed from claiming the federal earned income credit under current law. There's a provision that doesn't directly flow through to Minnesota. It's similar to a provision that we heard in the House Omnibus Tax Bill. It would allow individuals to use their 2019 earned income amount to qualify for the earned income credit in 2021. That would not flow through directly to Minnesota as a matter of federal conformity, but I included it in the table here because it's been sort of an issue of discussion in the tax committee thus far. Another change related to the federal earned income credit is the disqualified investment income test. There's a requirement in federal law that you are not allowed to claim the federal earned income credit if you have a certain amount of investment income. And the federal American Rescue Plan Act increases that investment income limit from $2,200 to $10,000, effective for tax year 21 and later. And that's a permanent provision that's it's indexed for inflation under current law, so the federal bill rebases it. The dependent care credit changes that I mentioned, under current law, the amount of eligible expenses that qualify for the dependent care credit are $3,000 for individuals with one dependent and $6,000 for individuals with two or more qualifying children. And the federal ARPA law increases that to $8,000 for taxpayers with one qualifying child and $16,000 for taxpayers with two or more qualifying children. That's for tax year 21 only. It also increases the threshold at which the percentage in the credit starts to phase down. Under current law, that's $15,000 of AGI, and it increases that to $125,000 of AGI. It also increases the maximum credit percentage to 50% of eligible expenses, and then the bill also adds a phase-out. Under federal law, the credit percentage phases down, but it never fully phases out. So the federal ARPA Act adds a phase-out at $400,000 of API. Those dependent care credit changes are one time. They're tax year 21 only. There's also some changes that affect federal adjusted gross income. So those would flow through to
Minnesota. Mr. Williams, just hold off there because you've got like kind of basically three basic areas that you have in your memos. And this was area first on the federal tax credit changes. So any questions, members, on that part? And we can come back later too. So on that. Okay, very good. Mr. Williams, the second part, if you will.
Chair Marquardt and members, there's also some changes to sort of the income definitions and what's included in federal adjusted gross income. And we've discussed this provision because we sort of had a mirror provision in the House Omnibus Tax Bill, but there is that exclusion for gross income for $10,200 of unemployment insurance compensation in tax year 2020. That's a one-year-only provision. And it applies to taxpayers with FAGI of $150,000 or less only. In tax year 21, there's a one-time increase in the amount of deployer-provided dependent care assistance. These are sometimes called dependent flex spending accounts. So under current law, the limits are $2,500. And that's a mistake in the memo. It's $2,500 for married taxpayers filing separately and $5,000. I think it's for married taxpayers filing jointly. So the federal ARPA law increases that to $10,500 on a one-time basis. It also includes an exclusion from gross income for discharged federal student loans. So federal student loans that are discharged from 2021 to 2025 that would otherwise be included in gross income are excluded from gross income for those 4 years. And I'll pause now for more questions if members have them.
Members, anything on that part, kind of the second of three? Very good. Mr. Williams.
Chair Marquardt and members, in the business tax changes, I'm going to talk about the first chunk of these, and then I'm going to hand it off to my colleague, Mr. Klayman. The first item on that list is the excess business loss limitation. The excess business loss limitation was included originally in the TCJA, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. That provision was scheduled to expire federally in tax year 2025, and we conform to that in the 2019 Omnibus Tax Bill. The ARPA law extends that expiration date by 1 year to tax year 26. There's a new, and we've dealt with a couple of other credits like this in the CARES Act and some of the in the Consolidated Appropriations Act 2021, but it's another employer credit that the federal government is providing to employers. Again, typically credits don't affect Minnesota liability, but in this case, but because this is a 100% credit. The law stipulates that the credit amount is added to gross income, so it affects gross income. So the bill essentially pays for COBRA expenses, 100% of employee COBRA expenses, and for employers and for certain covered employees. The way it works is their employers would pay their COBRA expenses, then would receive a 100% refundable tax credit applied against their payroll taxes. The payments to the individuals are excluded from gross income, and there's also a denial of double benefit provision for the employer payments. So that increases gross income, so that's why it's a matter of conformity. The credit for paid sick leave and paid family leave is extended until September 30th, 2021. That's a provision that was originally passed in the Families First Coronavirus Response Act and then extended. The employee retention credit that was passed in the CARES Act there's some modifications to the rules, and the credit is extended until December 31st, 2021. And I'm going to hand it off to my colleague, Mr. Klayman, to discuss this worldwide interest allocation issue.
Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Chair and members, so moving on to the next line on the chart that the committee was provided, this is the repeal of the election to allocate interest on a worldwide basis. This is Section 854F of the Internal Revenue Code. What this does is that it allows, what 864F did was, it would have allowed multinational corporations to allocate their interest on a worldwide basis. Right now, a foreign corporation cannot do that. Domestic corporations can. This is a unique provision, I think, because it has never been in effect at the federal level. And it was initially put into law in 2004, and Congress has kept kicking out the effective date, and they finally repealed it in ARPA. The impact of that is that there's no administrative guidance on this at the federal level. So it's unclear how it would be administered, and that will come into play in a conformity scenario, because if the legislature does not conform to ARPA, then theoretically the state may have to provide the worldwide interest allocation, because we would be using a prior version of the Internal Revenue Code where that section has not been repealed. And one of the possible ways this could affect the state is that, without getting too far into the weeds here, potentially what would happen is that a multinational might allocate interest away from a controlled foreign corporation, because that would increase their foreign tax credit. That's the reason why this existed in the first place. And when that happens, then more of the interest could be allocated to domestic corporations, which could increase the interest deduction that domestic corporations pay. So it's not clear that that's exactly what would happen or how it would be administered, but that's a possibility. I just thought I'd say a few extra words on that because it's a unique situation. And then moving on, the tax treatment for targeted idle advances and then tax treatment for restaurant revitalization grants. There are some new idle targeted loans in ARPA. There are also a new program, the restaurant revitalization grants. And essentially the conformity items there are that there is an exclusion from gross income for both of those amounts. And then there's also a prohibition on denying any tax benefits. So again, those two funds from those two programs would be treated similar to how PPP loans are currently treated in terms of the tax treatment. And then lastly, under the business conformity items is the expansion of the limitation on excessive employee remuneration. Under federal law, there's already a denial of a deduction for employee compensation over $1 million to the CEO, CFO, and the five highest compensated executive officers. And what ARPA does is it, top five, but the three highest compensated officers. And then what ARPA does is just expands that to say, aside from those individuals who are already included, the next five highest compensated employees would also have this denial of a deduction for employee compensation over $1 million. And so, Mr. Chair, that concludes the business conformity items and also everything that was on our handout.
Mr. Klayman, Mr. Williams, thank you so much. Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to just back up to one of the items that Mr. Williams had talked about, and that was what I believe he was referring to, clarifications on operating losses going forward. Talked about an extension by the Fed to 25 for a couple of years and the state till 26. I'm not sure if you meant NOL, but it is of concern for businesses who maybe incurred losses prior to COVID, that they be able to continue to recover and extend some of these net operating losses into those years. So I want to just ask, is the deduction for that admissible even if it was not COVID related and just extends the loss carry forward? Is that what's happening?
Representative Hertaus, are you looking at the top of the page three, the ninth section 9041, the excess business loss limitation?
Correct.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. So I think that's the 250,000 or 500,000 per couple limit. In so, Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chair.
Or Mr. Klayman.
Yeah, I think I'll take this one, Mr. Chair. Okay. I think it would just help to clarify a little bit what's going on with the excess business loss limitation provision. And for background, this goes back to the Tax Cut and Jobs Act in 2017. And there's a history here. And what happened in 2017 is that Congress in the TCJA is they created this excess business loss provision. And what it does is it says that you cannot offset non-business income with your business losses. So that would be like passive investment income or wage income. But there are thresholds, so you can offset up to 250 or 500,000 depending on your filing status of income. And any amount that you cannot take against that income then turns into a net operating loss that you can carry forward in future years as a net operating loss deduction. So that was the CARES Act. That's how the CARES Act worked. That's how the TCJA worked. What happened during the CARES Act came in, and the CARES Act suspended the implementation of that excess business loss provision, which under the TCJA was just temporary. And the CARES Act suspended that until tax year 2021. So what ARPA does then is it, so now essentially the situation with the excess business loss provision is that instead of being effective for 2018 to 2025, it's really only effective for 2021 to 2025. And what ARPA did is it kicked that effective date at the federal level out to 2026. So that's what's happening with the excess business loss provisions under ARPA. So I don't know if that answers Representative Hertaus's question, but I think that's some background on that that could at least explain some of what's going on here.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think that helps a little bit. I guess I was aware that previously, before COVID, NOL had a maximum of like 10-year carry forward in terms of being able to deduct those losses. And I was just curious if this language was basically extending that schedule for certain businesses that might still be in need of solvency during the COVID crisis.
Mr. Klayman.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Hertaus, the other thing that the TCJA did is it eliminated the length of time that you could carry forward a net operating loss. So it got rid of the carrybacks, but you can now carry forward net operating losses indefinitely. And so the EBL provision wouldn't change any of that. It would continue to have that provision in place. What EBLs do is they really increase the amount. In a way, they delay the timing of taking your net operating loss deduction, so they push it into the future. Instead of taking it in the year you have the loss, it gets taken in a future year. So that's how that would be mechanically how that would work.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Klayman, for validating what I thought was the current law and that it's not really disrupting that, because I think a lot of businesses who unfortunately did incur losses need to be able to continue to deduct that against future earnings. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. Thank you. Representative Swidzinski, you had your hand raised.
Yeah, Mr. I did put it down, but since I was just next on the list. Just a quick question, Mr. Klayman. You talked a little bit about that portion where for highest paid employees within business, they're limited to the first $1 million of essentially writing that off on taxes. Is that, did I hear you correctly?
Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Swidzinski, that's correct. So the first $1 million in compensation, you could still deduct that, but anything over that, you couldn't deduct. And that's just for a certain subset of officers and employees.
Representative Swidzinski.
Yeah, so my follow-up to that would have been, how would that handle with professional sports teams?
Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's a good question. There is a distinction in that provision between officers and employees. So employees would expand the range of who's covered by that. So that's an interesting question. I'd have to look into that a little bit more, but it's possible that it because of that difference, it's possible that could cover professional athletes.
Representative Swidzinski.
Thank you. So, Mr. Chair, members, so if that's the case, because the way I understood that language was that, if you've got the CEO or making over $1 million, then it also would capture then the next four or the next five highest paid employees, where they could only deduct the first $1 million of compensation, regardless of what their position is.
Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Swidzinski, that's close to how it works. It's grafted onto this existing federal provision. So it's the CEO and the CFO, and then the next three highest paid officers. That's current law. So that's who this applies to right now. At least I think it's the top three. And then in addition to those five positions, then there's the next five highest paid employees. And I think that's how this would work.
So I think maybe if there's more on this, we can go offline or get more information later too. So Representative Swidzinski, anything else? Representative Swidzinski, anything else?
Yes, I'm done. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you very much. Well, thank you, Mr. Williams. Thank you, Mr. Klayman. So we get a little idea of all the provisions except the one on the unemployment insurance, which we're dealing with, is actually tax years 21 and beyond. So members, I don't know when we're going to meet again, but keep your emails open. Representative Hertaus.
I know you're winding up. I just wanted to say I've been on taxes with you for 9 years. And the testimony we just heard from Klayman and Williams is fact certain that some very big shoes that we appreciated in house research that retired. These guys are just doing a stellar job of being able to inform us on current law. So thank you to both of you, men.
Thank you, Representative Hertaus. A great way to end the committee today, and thank you all. So with that, members, we are adjourned.